If you care to, open your Bibles to Isaiah chapter 6. Isaiah chapter 6, and read with me verses 1 through 5. In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the threshold trembled at the voice of him who called out, while the temple was filling with smoke. Then I said, "Woe is me, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Oftentimes we use this text here in Isaiah along with the one in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 17 when John sees the vision of Christ standing before him and talking with him to illustrate one's appropriate response to coming into the presence of the Lord, right? There, John in Revelation 1:17 falls down on the ground like a dead man. He can't even stand in the presence of the Lord. And here Isaiah's classic response, "Woe is me, I am ruined because I'm a sinner." And though I think that those are maybe some valuable lessons to learn from illustrations like this, accounts like this, the idea that we ought to be humbled by the righteousness of God, and that ought to illumine our own sinfulness. It ought to become so extremely obvious to us that we recognize without hesitation that we are wretches. And the idea of falling down on your face like a dead man, as John does in Revelation chapter 1, he recognizes when he's confronted with the power and the awesome might of Jesus Christ, the resurrected Lord, "I am nothing. I'm insignificant. I am powerless to stand in the presence of this one." And I think there ought to be a sense of fear and respect as we come before the presence of the King. But let me suggest to you that when we look at this text here in Isaiah chapter 6, there are more lessons that we could and should learn from this example here from Isaiah. And as we continue to periodically look at some of these Old Testament texts, I want us to think about the question, where am I in the text? Because if we're not seeing ourselves in the text, if we're not making application of it to ourselves, we're just reading stories. And the Bible's not just a good storybook. It's the instruction manual for our lives. So as we look at this section, I want us to try to put ourselves in Isaiah's shoes and see what he is seeing here if we can't come to appreciate and make better application of this important example from Isaiah. And I would suggest to you that ultimately what's happening for Isaiah here is that he is seeing God as the King. But in order for us to really appreciate the impact of that and the magnitude of what that means for Isaiah, we need to understand a little bit about the historical context here in which Isaiah experienced this vision of the Lord. We read there in chapter 6 and in verse 1, "In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne." And so Isaiah tells us exactly when this event happened. It was the year that King Uzziah died. We know from chapter 1 and verse 1 of Isaiah, Isaiah gives us the time frame of when he's doing his work. It seems that he comes back here in chapter 6 and talks about the time when he was initially called, because he'll say in 6 and verse 8, "I heard the voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send and who will go for us?' And then I said, 'Here am I, send me.'" Right? Isaiah is saying, "I'll do the work. I'll go and do it." Well, when was it that Isaiah was doing this work? If you go back to chapter 1 and verse 1, the book begins, "The vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, concerning Judah and Jerusalem, which he saw during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah." And so we're trying to think about the historical context in which Isaiah lived and worked and saw these visions and when these things happened. And he tells us that it was during the reigns of these four kings of Judah: Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Now, I brought it up here on a timeline, and that from the beginning of Uzziah's reign to the end of Hezekiah's reign, we have a period of about 106 years. Now, I would suggest to you that Isaiah probably wasn't doing all of his work over this entire period of 106 years, but we know for sure that it spanned at least a period of 38 years, because we saw there in chapter 6 and verse 1, in the year that King Uzziah died, so the last year of King Uzziah. And we also know from 2 Kings chapter 18 and verse 13 that he's still around in the 14th year of Hezekiah when Sennacherib, king of Assyria, comes in and besieges the city of Jerusalem. And so that would give us a period of at least 38 years that Isaiah is living in around Jerusalem in Judea, and he's prophesying, he's delivering these messages from God to the people. But it would appear that this event that we've read about in chapter 6 happened early on in the work of Isaiah's prophetic ministry. Now, again, I don't know exactly how old Isaiah the man was when he began his work as a prophet, when God called him and he said, "Here am I, send me." I don't know if he lived during the time period of any of the previous kings who sat on the throne of Judah before Uzziah came to the throne. But at the very least, I think that Isaiah would have been well aware of the history of his nation. And he would have known the history of the kings who had preceded those who sat upon the throne while he was doing his work. And what Isaiah knew about these previous kings was that before Uzziah came to sit on the throne, there was a series of very wicked kings who reigned over the southern kingdom of Judah. In fact, going back 80 years to the beginning of the reign of, I'll put it in air quotes, good King Jehoshaphat, because it does tell us in the historical record that Jehoshaphat did what was right in the sight of the Lord. But Jehoshaphat made some terrible mistakes, in my estimation. It's very clear as you read through. Go with me to 1 Kings chapter 22. And just notice this comment that's almost made, to us it seems like a passing comment, but I would suggest to you that it is rather significant in the train of events in the southern kingdom of Judah. In 1 Kings chapter 22, notice in verse 43, he walked, this is speaking of Jehoshaphat, he walked in all the way of Asa his father and did not turn aside from it, doing right in the sight of the Lord. However, the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and burnt incense on the high places. And then notice verse 44. Jehoshaphat also made peace with the king of Israel. And that would have been Ahab, who was sitting on the throne in the northern kingdom of Israel at the time. And Ahab was an exceedingly wicked man. And yet Jehoshaphat, for the first time, apparently, since the kingdoms divided under Jeroboam and Rehoboam, Jehoshaphat makes peace with his brethren in the north. And that peace seems to be solidified, that alliance between the kingdom of the north and the kingdom of the south seems to have been solidified through a marriage alliance. If you turn over to 2 Kings chapter 8, this is information about Jehoshaphat's son, Jehoram. But just notice what it says here in verse 18, that Jehoram walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, just as the house of Ahab had done, for the daughter of Ahab became his wife, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. It seems to me, if you put the puzzle pieces together, Jehoshaphat says to Ahab, his relative in the north, who was a wicked man, he says, let's get back together. Let's form an alliance. I tell you what, I've got my son Jehoram here. You've got your daughter Athaliah. Let's get them married together, and that will solidify our two kingdoms as one. The problem is that now with this heavy influence of Ahab's household upon the kings of Judah, we see a quick and drastic decline in the leadership. We've already read there, when you're thinking about Jehoram here, the son of Jehoshaphat, it said there in chapter 8 and in verse 18 that he walked in all the ways of the kings of Israel, just as the house of Ahab had done, because he was Ahab's son-in-law. I've got to keep my father-in-law happy with me, right? And so I'm going to do what he does. I'm going to follow in his ways and follow in his footsteps. And sure enough, that's what he does, leading the Israelites, the people of Judah, away into idolatry. I want to switch over here because we have dual records of these kings. We have them in 1st and 2nd Kings, and then we also have it in 1st and 2nd Chronicles. I'm going to spend the majority of the rest of our time this morning in 2nd Chronicles, which has this other account. But turn over there with me to 2nd Chronicles chapter 21, and notice what it says here about Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, beginning in verse 4. Now, when Jehoram had taken over the kingdom of his father, he made himself and made himself secure. He killed all his brothers with the sword and some of the rulers of Israel also. And Jehoram was 32 years old when he became king, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. And he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, just as the house of Ahab did, for Ahab's daughter was his wife, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. He ascends to the throne, and what's one of the first things that he does? He kills all of his brothers. He didn't want anybody threatening his position. And he's thinking like a worldly king. And he slaughters his own family. And does the things that the kings of the north would do. Not a good beginning to a dynasty. And it doesn't get much better after that. Because we continue reading in 2 Chronicles that Jehoram and Athaliah's son, Ahaziah, ascends to the throne when Jehoram dies. And Ahaziah had a very short reign. If you go over to 2 Chronicles chapter 22, 2 Chronicles chapter 22, verses 3 through 4, it says that he also walked in the ways of the house of Ahab, for his mother was his counselor to do wickedly. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord like the house of Ahab, for they were his counselors after the death of his father to his destruction. And Ahaziah here goes ahead and enters into, well, they're already really in an alliance with the northern kingdom of Israel. And Ahaziah goes and makes a pact with Jehoram, not his father, but would have been his uncle, essentially, the son of Ahab, and who's king of the north. And they go off to battle together, even though the Lord says, this is not going to turn out well for you. I'm not with you in this. And as a result, their armies are defeated and they kind of return back to Samaria, licking their wounds. And notice this as we read about the demise of Ahaziah. Again, only on the throne for a very short time. He's actually killed by Jehu, who was anointed by the prophets to come in and annihilate the household of Ahab because of their exceeding wickedness. And what's interesting as you read the account is that Ahaziah might have avoided his fate had he not been coming back from battle with the king of Israel. Because Jehu comes up to confront the king of Israel and slaughter him. And notice verse 7 of 2 Chronicles 22. Now the destruction of Ahaziah was from God in that he went to Joram. For when he came, he went out with Jehoram against Jehu, the son of Nimshi, whom the Lord had anointed to cut off the household of Ahab. God has sent Jehu to do his bidding, which is to kill Joram and his household, the household of Ahab. And Ahaziah says, I'll go out and help you fight against Jehu. Well, you continue reading. It came about when Jehu was executing judgment on the house of Ahab, he found the princes of Judah and the sons of Ahaziah's brothers ministering to Ahaziah and slew them. And he also sought Ahaziah, and they caught him while he was hiding in Samaria. And they brought him to Jehu, put him to death, and buried him. It's not going very well. And it gets worse. Because when Queen Mother back in Jerusalem finds out that her son Ahaziah has just been executed along with her father's entire household, she takes matters into her own hands. We read in verse 10, "Now when Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she rose and destroyed all the royal offspring of the house of Judah." And so Athaliah then takes the throne of Judah and basically slaughters all of her grandsons. She says, "I'm not letting any of Ahaziah's boys take the throne. I want it." And so she kills all of her grandbabies, save Joash, who was spared by his aunt, who was married to one of the priests of Judah. We read in verses 11 and 12, But Jehoshabeth, the king's daughter, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him from among the king's sons who were being put to death, and placed him and his nurse in the bedroom. So Jehoshabeth, the daughter of King Jehoram, the wife of Jehoiada the priest, for she was the sister of Ahaziah, hid him from Athaliah so that she would not put him to death. And he was hidden with them in the house of God 6 years while Athaliah reigned over the land. So you have this kind of reign of terror for about 6 years of this wicked queen, the daughter of Ahab, ruling over the people of Judah. And thank goodness that Joash is spared. And so when Joash is just a boy of about 7 years old, they bring him out of hiding and place him on the throne. And beginning with Joash, we have a series of what I'll put in air quotes, good kings leading up to Uzziah. But just notice with me why I say this. When we consider Joash, indeed, initially, he was a good king doing right. We read in 2 Chronicles chapter 24, beginning in verse 2, "Joash did what was right in the sight of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest," essentially his uncle. So as long as Jehoiada is there helping Joash reign, he's doing good. He's doing right. Jehoiada took two wives for him. He became the father of sons and daughters. Verse 4, "It came about after this that Joash decided to restore the house of the Lord. And so he gathered the priests and the Levites and said to them, 'Go out to the cities of Judah, collect money from all Israel to repair the house of your God annually, and you shall do the matter quickly. For the sons of the wicked Athaliah had broken into the house of God and even used the holy things of the house of the Lord for the Baals.'" That's the kind of stuff that was going on under Athaliah. They're using the temple of God to worship Baal. And Joash says, "We can't do this anymore. We've got to get back to serving the Lord." And so initially, he was a good king. But unfortunately, he later turned himself to idol worship and abandoned the work on the house of the Lord. If you jump down into the text of verse 17, it says, "But after the death of Jehoiada, the officials of Judah came and bowed down to the king, and the king listened to them. They abandoned the house of the Lord, the God of their fathers. They served the Asherim and the idols. So wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for this their guilt. Yet he sent prophets," that is, God sent prophets to them to bring them back to the Lord, "and though they testified against them, they would not listen." And then we have an account of a specific prophet who came and said to Joash and the other leaders, "You're not doing what's right." And that guy happened to be Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada the priest, who, if I'm reading this correctly, is actually Joash's cousin. And notice what he does when Zechariah comes and says, "God has forsaken you because you've forsaken God." Well, that makes him mad. In verse 21, "They conspired against him, and at the command of the king, they stoned him to death in the court of the house of the Lord." They're in the temple complex. In the court of the temple, they stone Zechariah, the cousin of King Joash, at the command of the king. Thus, Joash the king did not remember the kindness which his father Jehoiada had shown him, but he murdered his son. And as he died, he said, Zechariah says, "May the Lord see and avenge." And as you continue to read in the text, that's exactly what happens. From this point forward, Joash seems to turn from putting his trust in God to putting his trust in himself. We have an instance where the Arameans are coming down and they're attacking. And the only way that Joash can think to spare Jerusalem and to get the Arameans to leave is to take all of the treasures of his house and all of the treasures of the house of the Lord and everything that's been compiled up over the previous reigns and to give that to the king of Aram and say, "Please take this and leave us alone." And sure enough, it seems to work in the moment. But Joash hasn't escaped the vengeance of the Lord. Notice in verse 25 of chapter 24, when they had departed from him, that is the Arameans, they left him very sick. His own servants conspired against him because of the blood of the son of Jehoiada the priest and murdered him on his bed. So he died and they buried him in the city of David, but they did not bury him in the tombs of the kings. Because he killed his cousin, his servants conspired and killed him in his sleep. And so then his son, Amaziah, comes to the throne. We read in chapter 25, in verse 1, Amaziah was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jehoadan of Jerusalem. He did right in the sight of the Lord, yet not with a whole heart. And so we see Amaziah here. He too is initially good, but not fully. Because after he has a conquest against the Edomites, he brings the idols of Edom home and begins to worship those idols himself. And so he too turns to idolatry. If you turn in chapter 25, that should be verses 14 through 16. Now after Amaziah came from slaughtering the Edomites, he brought the gods of the sons of Seir, set them up as his gods, bowed down before them and burned incense to them. Then the anger of the Lord burned against Amaziah and he sent him a prophet who said to him, "Why have you sought the gods of the people who have not delivered their own people from your hand?" And as he was talking with him, the king said to him, "Have we appointed you a royal counselor? Stop! Why should you be struck down?" He's basically threatening this prophet of God. Shut up! Don't tell me what to do! Who asked for your advice? I could have you killed! All because he's pointing out the utter folly of his idolatry. The prophet stopped and said, "I know that God has planned to destroy you because you have done this and you have not listened to my counsel." And ultimately, Amaziah, he was taken as a prisoner by the kingdom of the north, the northern kingdom, back to the north. And he was put in prison there for the rest of his life. And so it's from the time that he was taken captive that we read in chapter 26 and verse 1, all the people of Judah took Uzziah, who was 16 years old, and made him king in the place of his father Amaziah. For a brief moment, the kingdom of Judah found themselves with no king on the throne because their king had just been taken as a prisoner of war. What are we going to do? Well, let's take his son and make him king. And so that brings us then to the reign of good King Uzziah. You can keep your finger here in 2 Chronicles 26 because we'll come back to that. But I want to just very quickly read the brief account of King Uzziah from 2 Kings chapter 15. And you'll notice here that he has a different name. It's not Uzziah, it's his alternate name, Azariah, but it's the same guy that we're talking about. And so in 2 Kings chapter 15 and verse 1, in the 27th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Azariah, that is Uzziah, the son of Amaziah, king of Judah, became king. He was 16 years old when he became king, and he reigned 52 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Jechaliah of Jerusalem. And he did right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father Amaziah had done. Only the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. And the Lord struck the king so that he was a leper to the day of his death. And he lived in a separate house while Jotham, the king's son, was over the household, judging the people of the land. Now the rest of the acts of Azariah and all that he did, are they not written in the books of the chronicles of the kings of Judah? And Azariah slept with his fathers. They buried him with his fathers in the city of David, and Jotham his son became king in his place. Now if you were to read just the account here in 2 Kings of Azariah or Uzziah, you might come away feeling somewhat unimpressed. If not thinking, well, Azariah wasn't that good of a king. In fact, God struck him with leprosy, apparently as punishment for something. Well, fortunately, we have that dual record in 2 Chronicles 26, which sheds a little bit more light on the reign of King Uzziah. So turn back over there to 2 Chronicles chapter 26. And I just want to make this observation. We're going to kind of go through and work our way through the section, but if you go to the end of the account in verse 22, it says, "Now the rest of the acts of Uzziah, first to last, the prophet Isaiah, the son of Amoz, has written." I find that interesting. Because not everybody is it pointed out that, hey, guess what? There's also more information about this king that was written by this specific prophet over here. In fact, the only other king who has anything pointed out that it was written by Isaiah the prophet about them is Hezekiah, who's not going to come onto the scene until 25 years after Uzziah's death. And I think to myself, why would Isaiah sit down and write all of the acts of Uzziah from first to last? Why would Isaiah the prophet make a record of this particular king and no other kings, except for Hezekiah, his great-grandson, who also happened to be a superb king over Judah? Maybe Isaiah had a special place in his heart for King Uzziah. Maybe he admired the king. Maybe he was somewhat enamored with King Uzziah and his reign as king of Judah. I don't know for sure if that's the case, but it's very clear that Isaiah seemed to hold a special place in his heart and at the very least deeply respect King Uzziah. And not for no reason. Uzziah was indeed a great king over the southern kingdom of Judah. Notice with me some of these points in the text here in 2 Chronicles chapter 26. He had one of the longest reigns of any king who reigned during the period of the divided kingdom. 52 years he sat upon the throne and reigned over Judah. We read that in verse 3. Of course, we've already read there in 2 Kings the fact that he was a good king who did right in the sight of the Lord. Here in 2 Chronicles 26 and verse 4, he says the same thing. He did right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father Amaziah had done. He continued to seek the Lord in the days of Zechariah, who had understanding through the vision of God. And as long as he sought the Lord, God prospered him. And indeed, God did prosper Uzziah as king. We read in verse 2 there that he built Eloth, which was a port town on the Red Sea that had been taken from Judah by the Edomites. And when his father went to war with Edom and conquered them, that city had been somewhat destroyed, though it had been taken back by the Judeans. And here, one of the first things that Uzziah does in his reign is he rebuilds that port town of Eloth, giving themselves an outpost of trade on the Red Sea. It's also very clear that he was successful at war. You read in verse 6, "Now he went out and warred against the Philistines and broke down the wall of Gath and the wall of Jabneh and the wall of Ashdod, and he built cities in the area of Ashdod and among the Philistines. God helped him against the Philistines and against the Arabians who lived in Gurbal and the Munites. The Ammonites also gave tribute to Uzziah, and his fame extended to the border of Egypt, for he became very strong." In fact, if you jump down to verse 11 through the beginning of verse 15, this is another unique feature of Uzziah, and that is the numbers of his army are recorded for us. Not very many kings had that recorded of them. So there must have been something significant about the might of Uzziah's army. We read, "Moreover, Uzziah had an army ready for battle, which entered combat by divisions according to the number of their muster, prepared by Jael the scribe and Messiah the official under the direction of Hananiah, one of the king's officers. And the total number of the heads of households of valiant warriors was 2,600. And under their direction was an elite army of 307,500 who could wage war with great power to help the king against the enemy. And moreover, Uzziah prepared for all the army shields, spears, helmet, body armor, bows, and sling stones. And in Jerusalem he made engines of war invented by skillful men to be on the towers and on the corners for the purpose of shooting arrows and great stones." I mean, he's built himself up a strong army. He's a powerful king. Who wants to reckon with Uzziah? Not only that, he seems to also have been very successful agriculturally and economically. If you go back to verse 9, it says, "Moreover, Uzziah built towers in Jerusalem at the corner gate and at the valley gate and at the corner buttress and fortified them. He built towers in the wilderness and hewed many cisterns. For he had much livestock, both in the lowland and in the plain. He also had plowmen and vine dressers in the hill country and the fertile fields, for he loved the soil." Judah is prospering under this good King Uzziah. They're stronger than they've been since the division of the kingdom. They're more economically powerful and they have more produce in the land. They are doing good. In fact, even the dual names of the king, Uzziah and Azariah, would indicate that he was very successful. Uzziah actually means my strength is Jehovah, and Azariah means Jehovah has helped. What a fitting name, because Jehovah had indeed strengthened and helped Uzziah to become this great king over the nation of Judah. And even when we consider the cause of his downfall, it's better than the downfall of his predecessors. Notice in verse 16, but when he became strong, his heart was so proud that he acted corruptly and he was unfaithful to the Lord his God. Because he went after idols? Because he abandoned the Lord? No. For he entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. He went in to worship his God. The problem was is that he had no business or authority to offer up incense in the temple. And so we read, Azariah the priest entered after him, and with him 80 priests of the Lord, valiant men, and they opposed Uzziah the king and said to him, it's not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. Get out of the sanctuary, for you've been unfaithful and will have no honor from the Lord your God. But Uzziah, with a censer in his hand for burning incense, was enraged. Nobody's going to keep me from worshiping my God. And notice what happened. While he was enraged with the priest, the leprosy broke out on his forehead before the priests in the house of the Lord, beside the altar of incense. And Azariah, the chief priest, and all the priests looked at him, and behold, he was leprous on his forehead, and they hurried him out of there. And he himself also hastened to get out because the Lord had smitten him. And King Uzziah was a leper to the day of his death, and he lived in a separate house, being a leper, for he was cut off from the house of the Lord. And Jotham, his son, was over the king's house, judging the people of the land. His big mistake was that he tried to worship his God in a way that his God had not authorized him to worship him. Still devastating, but I think it is better, if you'll allow me, than just turning wholesale away from God and seeking after idols. There's no doubt in my mind that Uzziah was a great king. Jim McGuigan, in his commentary on Isaiah, says, under Uzziah, the Judean nation was stronger and more prosperous than at any time since the kingdom of Israel had split in the days of Rehoboam. Thiele, in his book, The Mysterious Numbers of the Hebrew Kings, observes that at that time, Judah had such an outstanding king, possessing such marked abilities as a warrior and a statesman. In fact, so famous was King Uzziah, that Tiglath-Pileser III, king of Assyria, recorded this about him in his annals. He said, 19 districts of the town Hamath, together with the towns in their circuit, which are situated on the coast of the Western Sea, the Mediterranean Sea, which in their sin and wickedness sided with Azrijah. And I, Tiglath-Pileser, turned it into a territory of Assyria. That Azrijah there is Azariah. Different spelling of the same name. Even Tiglath-Pileser recognized the power of this king of Judah. In fact, the events that Tiglath-Pileser is recording here in his annals were probably things that happened after Uzziah was struck with leprosy towards the very end of his reign, probably actually in the last year of his reign of his life. And so even though his son Jotham was over the household judging the people of the land while Uzziah lived in a separate house, as we just read, that by no means indicates that Uzziah was no longer reigning over Judah and leading the armies that he had built up. In fact, the evidence would suggest that he reigned co-regent with his son for about 10 years, from the time he was struck as a leper until the day that he died. But the fact that Tiglath-Pileser gives credit here to Azrijah for the one who is leading this coalition in rebellion against him would indicate that even until his death, Uzziah was thought of as the king and leader of the nation of Judah. Howell M. Hayden, in his Journal of Biblical Literature, observes that Judah's greatest king since David, in body leprous but in mind alert as vigorous as ever, who in his last year planned the coalition of forces against Assyria mentioned by Tiglath-Pileser in connection with Azrijah. And so with that in mind, this good nature of King Uzziah, this noble leadership, this powerful presence that had led the small kingdom of Judah to this great prosperity. And here in his last year, he's organized this coalition to go up against the mighty king of Assyria. But now Uzziah is dead. And Isaiah's probably thinking, what's going to happen to the nation now? We're entering into a period of uncertainty. The lengthy, stable reign of Uzziah is over. He's dead. Is his son Jotham going to be able to continue to lead as effectively as his father now that the weight of the whole kingdom falls solely upon his shoulders? Will Assyria retaliate against Judah and snuff us out? What's going to happen now that the king is dead? Worry, doubt, fear would naturally arise in the mind of Isaiah in the year that King Uzziah died. And that brings us back to Isaiah chapter 6 and verse 1. Because it's at this very moment in the life of Isaiah and his experience, in the year of King Uzziah's death, Isaiah says, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. It was in the year of King Uzziah's death that Isaiah saw God sitting as king upon his throne. So let's make some application of this. I think the lesson that Isaiah is learning here in this experience is, as much as he respected Uzziah as king, as much as he looked up to Uzziah and trusted in him and was reliant upon his leadership, in this moment, Isaiah is realizing Uzziah is not the king. God is the king. You see, the people of Israel, long ago in the days of Samuel, had rejected God as being their king over them. Samuel, one of the last judges of the people, when he was getting old, the people came to him and said, Samuel, give us a king like all the other nations. We want to be like them. And Samuel's a little bit upset with them and frustrated. He says, no, you don't want that. It's not going to be good for you. They say, yes, we do. And so he goes to God and asks God, what should I do about this? And God says, give them what they want. They're not rejecting you, Samuel. They are rejecting me as their king. And from that time forward, the people of Israel were striving to serve God and serve their king. And I would suggest to you that even Isaiah had made the mistake of falling into this artificial and false dichotomy between serving God and serving the king versus serving God as the king. They were trusting in God and the king of Judah. That's what Isaiah was doing. He was trying to please God and trying to please the king of Judah. He was trying to serve God and serve the king of Judah. And what Isaiah realizes here, in the year that this great, powerful, mighty, noble, righteous, good king is taken away from him by death, that God is the king sitting on his throne. He always has been and he always will be. But it took the death of good King Uzziah for Isaiah to realize who was the real king. Well, how does that relate to us? Are we trying to serve God and serve the king? Seeking the things of God and seeking the things of the king? Putting our trust in God and putting our trust in the king? And you say, I don't have a king. There's no king ruling over me. I live in America. Well, who is your king? What's the thing that's ruling in your life? What's the thing that drives you? What's the thing that you put your trust in? What's your king? Is it yourself? Your own strength and your ability to accomplish things. Is that what drives you? Is that what you trust in? Maybe it's your family. Mom and dad have always been there for me. They've always helped me with anything that I need. You put your trust in mom and dad. Maybe it's your family, your kids and your extended family. Maybe it's your country or your community. We live in a good town. That's what I put my confidence in. The people of the community will come together and will help each other. Maybe we're putting our trust in our political affiliation or the government or the president or the strength of our economy. That's what I trust in. Everything will be okay because the economy is thriving. Maybe it's the pursuit of things. That's what rules you. Materialism. Getting a better job. More education so I can make more money, so I can accumulate more possessions, so that I can keep up with the Joneses. That's my driving force. That's what dominates my life. Is it the preservation of your reputation? I know I'm not that great of a guy, but I want everybody to think well of me. I want everybody to like my family and think I have a good marriage and that I'm doing a good job raising my kids. I want to be respectable in my community. I want to maintain my social standing. Is it your pride? Is that your king that you're serving? Maybe it's just your own selfish desires. Whatever makes me happy. My hobbies, my pastimes, recreation, recreational drugs. Whatever makes me happy, that's what I'm going to do. That's what's ruling in my life. That's what controls me. Guys, understand that is your king. And so maybe we're doing the same thing that Isaiah was doing. We're trying to serve God and serve our king. But I would remind you of what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 24. No one can serve two masters, for either he'll hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. Maybe we could just say, you can't serve God and anything else. What is it going to take for us to realize that simple truth? Is it going to take the loss of your king, just like it took the loss of Isaiah's king, for you to realize that God is sitting on his throne, that he is the king who deserves your total loyalty and absolute commitment and allegiance? Maybe you have to experience that calamity. Perhaps it'll be in the year that your family falls apart, that your marriage is in shambles, or that your adult children want nothing to do with you anymore. Maybe it'll be the year that your health fails. Maybe it's that you've lost a child tragically to cancer. Or maybe you yourself have been diagnosed with cancer or some other disease. Maybe you got COVID. And you realize, I'm not as strong as I thought I was. Perhaps it'll be in the year that you lose your job. Your company goes under, that you yourself go bankrupt, your house is repossessed because it was collateral, and you're left with nothing. Or that some natural disaster comes, you know, the house burnt down, The tornado came through and wiped everything out. The flood came and it's all gone. Everything is destroyed. Perhaps it'll be the year that you finally hit rock bottom and you find yourself in rehab because your addiction has finally caught up with you. It's wreaking havoc in your life. It's destroying everything. And you hit bottom. Perhaps it'll be in that year that you'll finally see the Lord sitting on His throne. Or perhaps you could learn the lesson from Isaiah here and recognize before the calamity that God is the King and that you need to serve Him and Him alone with all your life. So my question this morning is, do you see God as the King?